Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hello and welcome into Tunnel Vision, a show presented to you by USCFootball.com. I'm your host, Jack Smith, joined in studio by Shotgun Spratling and Chris Trevino to talk USC's 48-45 rivalry victory in the Rose Bowl against UCLA. Before we get to all that, make sure you're leaving your comments in the chat, whether you're watching on YouTube or Twitter. And we're taking live callers today, 512-4-TUNNEL. Make sure you're calling in so that we can get your thoughts on the show. Before we get to all that, fellas, what an amazing game out in the Rose Bowl last night.
It was a fun one. Unfortunately, it looks like our caller studio just went down, so we may not be able to accept your calls today. So that means get in the thread, get active. We want to hear from you guys. We wanted to hear your guys' voices and listened to what you had to say about the game last night. But unfortunately, it looks like that may have went down. So give it a try and see if it works. If it doesn't, then get in the thread. Make sure that you're participating as well.
That's what I was looking at. I was like, did the call just drop? Did the call just drop? Look, you give me 2 minutes, I can probably fix it. But in terms of my reaction to the game, what a wild game. What a fun game. What a thrilling game to cover. And it beats the games we were covering last year.
And just a little bit.
Just a little bit. And, you know, what an atmosphere in the Rose Bowl and, you know, rivalry game. Championship berth on the line for USC. A lot of things on the line for USC. You know, potential playoff spot down the line. I'm sure we're going to talk about that today. But just so much riding on this game, and USC came to play, whether that's Caleb Williams, whether that's, you know, somebody stepping up in the moment, whether a Corey Foran, a Darren Barlow, a Kyle Ford, getting Jordan Addison back. And then just the defense. I know, you know, give up 45 points. That's not the greatest thing in the world, but to step up and have four turnovers, including the game ceiling turnover, just wow, what an impressive effort, especially for a defense that has been heavily criticized throughout the month of November. But to come up with four turnovers in a game like this that means essentially everything to their season is impressive.
Not everything to their season, but everything for the next 12 months as well, as far as those bragging rights. I know you USC fans are, you know, relishing in the fact that you will get to spend the next 12 months talking about that to any UCLA fans and friends that you may know, because they've had that right for the last 12 months after, you know, putting up 62 points. And one of the things I thought was interesting is they continued that right through this week, including Dorian Thompson-Robinson talking about how he wanted to put up 60 again against USC, how he hates those guys over there, referencing USC. Just the trash talk that went through the week from the UCLA side, while USC didn't have anything to say. And it's kind of, you know, when you get beat like they did last year, you don't have the right to say anything. And so USC didn't say anything, but after the game, they did have some things to say. And Brett Nealon, you know, calling them teddy bears, those teddy bears over there, those little teddy bears, I think is what he said, and tell them they could say whatever they want, but we run LA, was his quote. But then, hearing Tuli Tuipulotu talk about the revenge tour that USC has been on, and Taj Washington, you know, the get-backs that they've been wanting to try to, this season, getting back those losses that they had to take last year, the abuses that they suffered. And, to find a way to get all the way to the Pac-12 championship after being 4-8 last year is just it's kind of mind-boggling. If you would have seen this team, if you were in person watching this team walk out of the Cal tunnels, you know, as we were, and you know, Brett Nealon, Andrew Voorhees, and those guys that, you know, we talked to as they were leaving, and the question was, they knew that Lincoln Riley was coming, but the question for them was, are you going to just go ahead and move on with your career? Are you going to come back for an extra year? What's kind of the plan there? And, you know, Andrew Voorhees is one who we anticipated was going to leave. He was planning to leave. I've been told that he had, you know, even told Lincoln Riley at one point that he was leaving and then backtracked that a couple days later. So, you know, those players decided to come back for moments like they had last night. And, you know, it was awesome to be down there. You know, just some of the guys that we've known for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, some of them, from covering them in high school and stuff. It was awesome to see them get to relish in that moment after the game. So that was really fun to just kind of witness and, you know, be a fly on the wall as they were celebrating that in the end zone after that game.
Speaking of the Cal game, do you know who the final player I interviewed from that night was? Basically by myself.
Was it Brett Nealon?
No.
No, because he had multiple people around him. Corey Foreman.
Yes. It was Corey Foreman. And
yeah,
just to see that, you know, essentially a year later to have him.
And because at that time, a lot of people were saying, you know, is Corey Foreman going to transfer? You know, and that was one of the things, you know, when we're just after a game, just behind the scenes a little bit, game ends previously, not this year because they bring everyone into us, but we would say, okay, who do we need to make sure that we get, and then who would be other people that would be good, you know, what's some good topics, that type of thing. And that was one of the people we brought up, is that people want to know about Corey Foreman and his status going forward. So Chris interviews him, and, you know, it's long 12 months ago, it feels like, after that play last night.
And I straight up asked him, do you intend to come back? And he was like, yes, I intend to be, you know, part of this team with this new coaching staff, Lincoln Riley. And, you know, he's, you know, battle some criticism this year, just like he did his freshman year. But, you know, to come up with that play in the end, you know, I know it felt really good for him. I know it felt really good for a lot of fans that have been huge Corey Foreman supporters, and to see all that talent on the field. And that's why he's a 5-star. Just see the way he was able to move out there, make that catch, steal that game. That's why he was the number one player in the country during his cycle. So to have him have that and make that play is just an incredible. And that's why he loves sports, because things like that happen. You never know who's going to make the play, and ends up being number zero, agent zero, which is really cool.
And one player we haven't mentioned, and I thought it was, you know, from the emotions of the week for Bobby Haskins to come into that game, and I thought the offense changed when he came into the game. Just, you know, that's when they started moving the ball much more consistently. It was much smoother of an operation, it felt like. And I don't know, you know, I haven't got a chance to really rewatch the game and really focus. But I don't know if, you know, young players, especially young local players, can be overwhelmed in the moment because of a big game. You get too hyped up, too emotional. And I think you saw that a little bit with Raleigh Brown. I think, you know, first time in the rivalry game, trying to do a little bit too much at times. And I think he got affected a little bit. But maybe Mason Murphy kind of got overwhelmed a little bit. I'm not sure. But the coaching staff decided to go with Bobby Haskins and put him into the starting lineup after starting Mason Murphy for once again, which I thought was interesting, especially since Lincoln Riley said that Bobby would be, you know, fully healthy going into this week. But he comes into the game, and the offense changes then. And, you know, I didn't get to see it at the time, but seeing the video of it afterwards and seeing the clips that a couple people have posted, you know, where him just in tears after the game, you know, it was an emotional moment for him. Because every rivalry game has that emotion, even though he hasn't been in this rivalry. You know, you start feeding off of your teammates' emotion. You're going to battle with them, you know, guys that have been here before, all that type of stuff. And then, you know, that emotion kind of rolls into the emotions that he obviously had been going through all week with the tragedy at UVA. So I think he's a guy that isn't being noted, but had a big impact on this game, I think.
And I don't know if people saw that photo that USC Athletics posted, but great shot of a Virginia t-shirt. I'm assuming it's one of his when he was there, and just had the numbers of, you know, his former teammates that were slain in that tragic event. So hanging up in his locker. So just a great shot. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. But yeah, definitely a lot of emotion coming from Bobby Haskins and everyone around him. When I stumbled upon that scene when he was hugging Benny Wiley after the game, and just everyone around them was like affected by that emotion, not just obviously because of what they just accomplished and be able to secure a spot in the championship, but just doing it for him and, you know, the week that he's had.
Yeah, I think there were a lot of things that were expected that ended up happening last night. Of course, rivalry game. There was a lot of emotion, as Lincoln Riley mentioned, he expected would happen. Everyone thought it was going to be a shootout, and that's exactly what it was. And you just go to the end of the game. It couldn't, I don't think, end in a more unexpected way with Corey Foreman getting onto the field, which has been a struggle for him this year, even though we all know he has that talent. And then making a play, not rushing the passer like we expected to see him if he was on the field, but in coverage, lurking Dorian Thompson-Robinson for his third interception of the night. We'll talk about the offenses, I'm sure, but let's start by talking about that USC defense forcing four turnovers. Yes, they allow 45 points, but in the end, they're the one to make the play to win the game after the USC offense couldn't score. They were stopped, had to punt, and then Corey Foreman and the defense come up and make a big play.
Yeah, and I'll let Chris kind of answer about the defense and creating the turnovers, but you talk about unexpected ending. And not necessarily Corey Foreman dropping back. That wasn't, you know, I chuckled at when you said that, but the fact that there were back-to-back defensive stops in the final six and a half minutes, I think it was, no one scored. The first 9.5 minutes of the game, three straight defensive stops, no one scores.
And a turnover.
And so in that's basically one-third of the game. It's like 19-something minutes, so almost 20 minutes of the game. One-third, no one scores. The other two-thirds of the game, was it 93 points were put up, or was that what the final tally was? Like, it's just kind of – it's unfathomable kind of the way the game started and, you know, just no one being able to get any consistent – USC getting a three and out to start the game. And then to end the game with back-to-back defensive stops. And, you know, I was talking on the sideline with Jordan Moore, USC's radio guy, and, you know, some other people. And, like, it felt like, you know, start of the fourth quarter, USC scores touchdown on first play. The very next offensive play is a touchdown. And you go, okay, is it that point in the game where one defensive stop, whoever makes the next defensive stop is going to win this game? Because either USC is going to be able to, you know, to pull ahead by, you know, multiple scores, and, you know, UCLA is not going to be able to keep within 3 points, or UCLA is going to be able to retake the lead because, you know, if you make one stop, you're going to score right after it. And to get back-to-back stops, and I know a lot of USC fans were probably, you know, when they have to punt the ball there, like, it's over. It's we can't win this game now. We haven't stopped them all the second half, it doesn't feel like. And, you know, for USC to find a way, I even tweeted after the third down stop, or the third down before that, third and 10, that, you know, that was their opportunity. You know, it felt like that was the opportunity, third and 10, to get off the field, and they didn't do it. So maybe it was just the next third down that I had to do it. Third and 5, and Corey Foreman comes with a great play.
Yeah, the defense is just like that. Your point to where early on, a lot of defense. Early on, at the end, we end with some defense. It just felt like that old guy at the rec league that goes super hard in the first 5 minutes of the game. He's like, I got to check out. And then he's on the bench for the whole rest of the game. And then he checks in for the final thing and he makes the play or something. So that's kind of what it felt like. Just taking a break.
What an analogy.
No food analogies for me. Weird sports analogies. That's what I make. But you said you were going to let me talk about the turnovers. And four of them, which they haven't forced since, I believe, the Fresno State game or something like that. Someone will correct me on when they got
four. Sounds correct, but I'm not going to go off the top of my head.
But anyway, they haven't had turnovers like that in bunches in a long time. I believe Colorado was the first time they've had multiple in a game in quite some time. But 45 points, shotgun. We know USC's defense isn't a defense that's going to shut you down to less than 20 points. We know it's a bend don't break defense. You know they're going to give up yards. You know that they're going to have a couple of busts every now and then. But early in the season, what were they doing? Taking the ball away. And you got a early season performance out of this defense where they came up with the stops, doing it the best way they know how, taking the ball away. And they all felt, outside of Mekhi Blackmon's gimme pick, it all felt just kind of random. Like Corey Foreman, you know, in coverage, coming up with a sack, looking like a wide receiver, random. Tyrone Tulenei, you got the nation's sack leader, but it's Tyrone Tulenei that comes up with the big sack and strip sack. Latrell McCutchen scoops up. And then Shane Lee, like barely 6 foot Shane Lee, going up over the middle,
this one was your
showing
favorite.
The hops over the middle after, you know, they just gotten another turnover earlier, like the series before. They just came out of nowhere. It wasn't anything like super, it wasn't like a star power kind of deal. It was just like guys were just making the plays and it didn't matter where it came from. Didn't have to be Kalen Bullock. Didn't have to be Tuli Tupelo. It could have been Tyrone Tulenei. It could have been Shane Lee jumping the highest he's ever jumped in his career. Making that play, or
and making the catch with a cast on his thumb.
With a cast on his thumb, yes. Just all these plays, you know, the defense showed up when they needed to. They got bruised and bloodied, but man, they came out on top.
I will say the Shane Lee interception was, I thought, the craziest one, because I turned to, I don't know if it was you, Chris, but the play before that was a Max Williams dropped interception, which he might have had 6 points on. I turned to you with, I think there was 20 seconds left, and I said, okay, well, there you go. Now Chip Kelly's not going to throw the ball again this half. Next play, same thing, Dorian Thompson-Robinson over the middle of the field, gets picked off by Shane Lee. Chaos ensues where Dennis Lynch misses a field goal short, but there was a timeout, and so he kicks a field goal again, and he ends up making it. It was just a lot of craziness, but there were so many plays by the USC defense that, while unexpected, were the reason I think that they won this game, because it was a three-point margin. You come up with four turnovers, and you only turn it over once. That makes a big difference.
Yeah, definitely, and that's what we've said about this defense, you know, that they're not going to shut people out, but can they create explosive plays? And that was what UCLA's defense did in the first half, is, you know, they basically followed the USC formula of bend but don't break, get in the red zone, and okay, if you can get one big sack or you can create a turnover, you know, you get off the field. And even if the offense now has to go, you know, 90 yards versus going 5 yards like USC did when the Tulane sack, you're still giving that offense a chance, and you trust in that offense that they can go 90 yards. It's not a big deal for them. So USC, that's the big thing. It's just, as long as you don't give up seven, then you consider it a positive drive. You can give up three every single drive, and you would still feel comfortable that your offense will outscore the opposing team. You know, no matter what, if the opposition gets 8-10 drives, you feel like, okay, if they get 10 drives and get 3 points each time, USC could still win that game. And that's what UCLA was doing early. That's what USC eventually did in the game, is started creating those turnovers. And I thought it was interesting, you know, the run game was working for UCLA early, and then when they went in that two-minute drill, that's what shifted everything. And they probably still had time where they could have run the ball on that drive. Instead, the first pick to Mekhi Blackmon, instead they put the ball in DTR's hands, and he throws that interception. And you call it a gimme. I couldn't really see it from my angle, but, you know, it seemed like a pretty easy pick for Mekhi Blackmon, just stepping in front on that one. But, you know, there was an opportunity there for UCLA to, you know, what we've talked about with USC all season, is step on their neck. You know, right before the half, because they're getting the ball back after the second half, if they can score on a drive and then score once more, suddenly USC's in the biggest hole they've been in all season. How do they respond to that? Because, you know, it's in the first quarter, it's, you know, whatever, you can come back from that. When it's halftime or it's after halftime, now all those local guys start feeling that pressure a little bit more. And does someone make a mistake because of the extra pressure? Whereas it played out, USC was able to get that field goal late to get them a little bit closer. They hold UCLA to a field goal on the opening drive of the second half, and then Jordan Addison scores a touchdown. Now USC's ahead, and they never trail again. So they're not chasing the entire second half with an opposing crowd going against them and whatnot. So I thought that sequence right before the half is what completely changed the game, or the middle eight, as they call it. I think that's where USC won the game. And it started with that interception by Mekhi Blackmon, followed up by Shane Lee, and holding UCLA to that field goal to open the second half.
There were three stats that I covered for our student radio pregame show. One of those was that middle eight. USC this season, second in the Pac-12 in middle 8 points. So that's the last 4 minutes of the first half and the first 4 minutes of the second half. They had scored 55 points this season. UCLA only scored 27. So that was a prime position that USC needed to win that, especially going down 14-0 early. And then also on the defensive side of the ball, UCLA was 0-2 this year, where DTR threw more passes than they had rush attempts on the day. He had one more pass attempt than UCLA did rushing attempts yesterday night, and that one was a very big one at the end with the Corey Foreman interception. The other one, which you kind of mentioned, Chuck, and where the UCLA red zone defense stepped up, they had been 121st in the country going into the game, allowing a touchdown on 91% of opponent red zone drives. And USC, I think, started 2-for-5 on touchdowns in the red zone on their first five, and the third one was a missed field goal. I don't remember exactly the stats are, but I think they were 2-for-5 touchdown-wise on their first five trips to the red zone against what was the 121st worst red zone defense in the country.
Yeah, and that's why UCLA was leading at the half, and that's why, you know, they had a great opportunity in that game to, like I said, take control in that middle, and did not do it. And give credit to the USC defense, especially after, you know, that sequence. You know, they got the three and out early, but then it basically been run through the rest of the first half until the very end, and came up with a couple big plays that change the course of the game. And you know, we talked about a lot of different players stepping up, and give Corey Foreman a lot of credit on that, flipping his hips on that. You see why he was the number one player in the country on that type of play, because that's not a play that Nick Figueroa or Solomon Bird is probably making just with the athleticism, the fluidity that Corey Foreman was able to make it with. So that's why he's up there. But you also give credit to him for putting in that work. And we heard everyone talking about it, after the game of, what he's been doing throughout the process, and they're starting to reward him. He's earned that opportunity. Made a couple plays early in the Colorado game, halftime. He comes out and he's the starting rush in to start the second half against Colorado. I thought that was interesting. And then last night, I noted it, and I didn't have time to tweet it because everything was going so crazy. But he's the one that started that final drive. This is a win or lose drive for USC as a defense. And the person that they trusted to put on the field at that rush in spot was Corey Foreman. Now, part of that is because of the way they were playing DTR in that situation and dropping at times, and that's why they had Tuli Tuipulotu standing in the middle of the field and doing his kind of faux linebacker coming up and attacking from the second level. They were doing different things there, but they trusted Corey Foreman to be out on the field at that time. So I think that says a lot about his development, the work he's put in. And everyone expected him to be the dude immediately. It hasn't happened, but we're seeing those bits and bits of it. And Alex Grinch said they've been waiting for a breakout, and they're hoping that that play that they saw Saturday, along with a couple plays against Colorado, can be the catalyst to what can be for him the rest of the season.
Absolutely. Very quickly, can we just talk about how Zach Charbonnet bottled up for most of the night? I think that was an underrated kind of storyline from tonight. And I remember turning to Jack and being like, I feel like they're doing an okay job on Charbonnet. They're not doing an amazing job. They're doing an okay job, which for this USC defense is an amazing job. And that's a guy who I saw pregame putting on a giant bib around his neck in anticipation of facing off against this USC run
licking
defense.
His chops?
Licking the chops. He was drooling at the mouth for this USC run defense. And lo and behold, they hold him to under 100 yards. Just the second team to do that this season. I believe he had six consecutive games of at least 100 yards, and his last four or five, he had over 150. Mm-hmm. So he had been eating going to this game, and USC had an answer for him because you knew you could not leave the Rose Bowl with a win if both Zach Charbonnet and DTR both went off. You needed to limit one of them. And for the most part, with four turnovers against ZTR, you shut him down for the most part. And then to hold Charbonnet to under 100 yards, that's just extra cherry on the top for this shutting down their stars.
Yeah, he didn't have explosive runs. And he didn't have explosive plays out of the backfield. That's what he's been so good with, because, they tackled well against him. That was an issue for, 3-4 weeks in a row, just not tackling. And Zach Charbonnet is a guy that breaks tackles, at will, basically. So it usually takes more than one person to get there to bring him down. So give a lot of credit to the defense for rallying to the ball and being explosive when they get there to stop some of those extra yards that he's normally able to get. So I thought, they did a good job on him. I also thought UCLA went away from it more than they should have. Like, it felt like, why are you not using Zach Charbonnet more? I mean, we say that he got bottled up. He still ran for 5 yards a carry. He ran, I think it was 16 times for 90 yards or 18 times for 90 yards. So,
hey, against his defense, that's like three.
True. I mean, it's a good job. I'm not saying it's not a good job for USC, but if your running back is getting 5 yards a carry, why not use that more often? This is the type of game where sometimes you got to rely on that running back to go 25 carries maybe. And 25 is a high number these days, but I was talking with someone before the game, and they were rattling off Marcus Allen stats from his Heisman year, talking about how he basically was carrying 37 times a game. So, this is not – it's not unheard of to be able to, in a rivalry game, add a couple more carries on there. And it's similar – I'm sure UCLA fans are saying the same thing that we've heard USC fans say throughout the season when Travis Dye's run the ball well. It's like, why are they not giving him the ball a little bit more? And Charbonnet is a guy that is even bigger than Dye, so he can handle the contact a little bit more, so you don't fear about that. So I was a little baffled that they didn't – that they trusted DTR so much that they – went away from Charbonnet at times.
I call that the Marquise Step syndrome.
Could be.
He's averaging 6 yards a carry. Why not give him the ball more?
That's an interesting question. But no, this offense, we want to do this and this and this. And sometimes you want to exploit things. You want to get so creative. When sometimes it's like, this is working. And that's been one of the reasons why I thought it was so interesting is because Chip Kelly is known for, you know, if you can't stop a play, he'll run it 6 times in a row at you. And it felt like they went away from Charbonnet much sooner than they needed to in that game. So I thought that one that helped out USC's defense. So when they bottled him up, and I thought it was interesting, Alex Grinch's comment, he was asked about bottling up Zach Charbonnet. He said, well, I would say Thule. One word, Thule.
Well, I think it's pretty fair. I think Tyrone Tulenei had a big hand in that as well. There were some plays early on in the second half where them two were just kind of causing a lot of chaos up the middle. But I think that's why it's so important that USC was able to come down 14-0 and why it seemed like such a big deal when they initially went down 14-0, because the key, as you, Arizona and Oregon laid out, was you need to make DTR throw the ball more than you can run it. If they had a 14-0 lead and they've got Chip Kelly at the helm, where you mentioned he'll run the same play 6 times in a row, it kind of felt like you were going to see Charbonnet get those 30 carries. USC came back pretty instantly. They ended up going on a 34-10 run after that, which is just kind of a crazy thought. How many games last year did USC not even score 34? Someone wants to put that in the chat. I'm curious about that. But being able to come back and not only come back to tie it or keep it close, but eventually take a big enough lead where UCLA could not run the ball quite as much. And with Caleb Williams and the USC offense moving the ball up and down the field so easily, it's hard, I bet, as Chip Kelly not to feel the pressure of Caleb Williams on the other side and then stay patient enough to run the ball. And that's sometimes where UCLA has run into some issues this year. DTR had a great game. I mean, 6 total touchdowns, but if you make him throw the ball a little bit more, it was laid out and there are 2 losses, he will sometimes make a mistake that loses them the game.
Have we even really mentioned Caleb Williams yet?
No, I think we should talk about the USC offense.
I mean, we did start with the defense and give them a lot of credit.
You haven't taken us on that tangent yet.
But how about the Heisman-worthy performance from Caleb Williams? And after seeing Hendon Hooker go down with an injury, seeing Blake Corum go down with an injury, I don't think C.J. Stroud's numbers were great. I haven't checked those yet, but
play that Maryland defense.
Drake May, who a lot of people like to move above Caleb Williams, didn't even throw a touchdown.
Yeah,
he did, and then it was dropped in the end. Oh, but
catch the ball. But all the other Heisman favorites in the conversation didn't really do anything this week, and Caleb Williams did on a big stage. So I wouldn't be surprised when the odds, you know, the odds that I get emailed to me are come every Monday, I believe it is. So I wouldn't be surprised if he's at the lead tomorrow, or at least right behind C.J. Stroud. So we'll see. You know, those Heisman odds, it's feeling more and more likely that Caleb Williams is at least headed for a trip to New York if he plays his normal game the next 2 weeks against Notre Dame and, in the Pac-12 championship. So he was spectacular. 470 yards passing, only 3 touchdowns in this game, and that seems like a very low number just because he'd had 5 in the 4 games previous, in each of the 4 games previous. So he throws for 2 touchdowns, connecting with Jordan Addison, connecting with Kyle Ford, runs for another one. But USC's ground game was really good too. So that's where a lot of the touchdowns went, with Austin Jones getting in twice, Darlon Barlow getting in. So the offense was rolling after that first quarter. The first quarter, they moved the ball well, but stalled out in the red zone. But they cleaned those issues up the rest of the game. Need to get a little bit more consistency out of Dennis Lynch. Obviously, kicking the 49-yarder shows what he can do right after he kicked it short. And I think he was thinking too much. And usually if a kicker kicks it short like that, when they have the leg, that means they're thinking about it. Oh, I got to make sure I hit it perfectly. And he just let it go on the next one and banged it through. And that was his last attempt. So I think that's a positive sign for him to grow off of. But you got to be able to hit the chip shots. Like that, those are the ones that cost you games and really tight games potentially. So they need a little bit more consistency there. But to see the run game really run, to really get going without Travis Dye, what was a positive. And again, this is all after those first couple drives, because 4th and 1, you know, that has been an easy money play for USC. 3rd and 1, 4th and 1s with Travis Dye, and they get stuffed the first time without him. I think that was kind of telling of the impact he's had this season. But they bounced back from it, and they did that throughout the game. And you saw different receivers stepping up, you saw different running backs stepping up, you saw different linemen come in. Bobby Haskins coming in, and you know, the offense running much smoother after he came in. So the offense was terrific. We expected that because UCLA's defense is boo boo, but you still have to go out there and perform, and especially after a slow start, you got to be able to bounce back, and they did that.
You just put a bunch of dishes on the table, and I don't know where to start first.
And this is a Thanksgiving's come early. Buffet meal. Let's go. You get to pick and choose, Chris.
Whatever, well, whatever you leave, I'll talk.
I just wanted to say, in terms of Caleb Williams and the sort of Heisman race ongoing, the Heisman is not won here. The Heisman is won here in November in the last four or five games of the season. And Caleb Williams, as we know, has been playing lights out in the month of November, racking up touchdowns, taking care of the ball, doing with his legs, having those black magic moments where he's escaping sacks and pressures and making these incredible throws with the help of some incredible catches from his wide receivers. So it's all clicking right now for Caleb Williams and this march towards the Heisman. And getting to New York, you know, if he plays another, like you said, up to what he's been playing like the last couple weeks against Notre Dame, you know, I would say he's booked the ticket. Figure out your lodging for New York.
I think he already has his ticket.
I mean, the thing I asked Ryan last night is if he was going to stay with me in Philadelphia and then we were going to go up to New York or if, you know, I was just going to meet him in New York. Because that's kind of the question right now, especially with the fact that there is no single person that is, you know, a front runner. Because then if there's a front runner and, you know, that means the ballot is pretty narrow. And usually that means there's only three finalists. When the ballot is kind of widespread like this, that can be four or five finalists that get invited to New York. So with that potential, I think he's definitely in the top five.
Are we still waiting for the Heisman moment? The Heisman game? You know, that singular, like I thought it was going to come on that final drive. I thought it was going to be like, bam, third down, scramble, shoot over the middle, hits Michael Jackson in the chest. Seals the game. That's what I thought was coming on that final drive. I still think we're looking for that Heisman moment. What do I know? Lincoln Riley's won three Heisman winners. Doesn't matter what I think. But I feel like from a media standpoint, you're still waiting for that Heisman moment. You're still waiting for that Heisman, quote-unquote, game.
I mean, he had that Heisman moment. It was just on the Pac-12 network against Oregon State. Damn. I mean, that final drive was the potential.
But what did I say?
Exactly.
It's not there.
And
it's
also here. On national television versus.
We saw it. No one else did.
That's true.
I got a great video of it.
Brilliant throw.
Again, you need your Heisman moment somewhere in here because no one's going to remember it over here. You're going to remember right here.
And, you know, he's getting the pub that he needs as well. You know, when Joel Klatt is the analyst, and Joel Klatt, obviously being a quarterback, breaks down things really well. He's one of the best in the business at breaking down things, and he says certain things on the broadcast that showcase what Caleb Williams is doing that, you know, your normal B team, C team analyst may not pick up on. I think that definitely helps you. And that's the product of having the big games at the end of the year on the national broadcast where you're going to get the top, you know, where you're getting Herb Street or you're getting Klatt or, you know, whoever it is that can really identify those things and then bring it to your casual viewer to be like, oh, okay, that yeah, I really do see that. And it also, you know, the people who vote on it, the media members, they like being told what's really good too because they're trying to work on all their stories and stuff at the same time and they're listening to it more than they're watching it. So that can definitely help. So a lot of factors, I think, are helping Caleb Williams out right now. But obviously, he's got two more games to showcase himself. And if he does that, again, I think he's at least in Vegas. I mean, in
Vegas.
New York.
He's already got Vegas on his mind. He's ready to play some blackjack.
He will be ready. In Vegas as well. We do know that. Because guess what? USC is the Pac-12 champions. At least in the Pac-12 championship, sorry.
Before we move on, can I do like 45 seconds on Darren Barlow?
Absolutely.
I want to take this moment to say, I tweeted this out about how that moment of just having Darwin Barlow, number 22, who, Shotgun can back this up or blow it out of the water for me, has not played like a legitimate like money... That's not the right word. Like non-garbage.
He hasn't played with the first team.
Yes. Like a non-garbage time snap. And then to have his number called in arguably the most important drive of the season, you need a touchdown here because UCLA is whooping you right now. They're scoring on you at will. You need a touchdown to keep that extra breathing room with a 10-point lead because you know they're going to score again. So in the most important moment, who does they call? 22. Darwin Barlow, and not only does he have the touchdown run, but he has a, you pointed out, a grown man dog run, the run before, takes a kidney shot, keeps rolling, and then to have his number called again, and he delivers, lowers the shoulder in the end zone. I mean, what a moment. And just see the emotion of him. I tweeted out that touchdown earlier today because I loved it so much. Just his reaction of just letting it all hang out, letting it all loose, and just seeing everyone celebrate him. Because, you know, Darwin is obviously someone that has fallen down the depth chart in terms of that stack room. You had Travis Dye. Austin Jones was up there. Relique Brown was getting touches. Darwin Barlow was getting touches here and there. We've seen him score a couple times this season, get a couple carries in garbage minutes. But, you know, for him to have that moment in the Rose Bowl was just awesome, first of all. And then to hear how excited everyone was for him, just, you know, Austin Jones saying, you know, he was so happy and proud for him, and they had their moment on the sideline to have him step up. And I think that goes to, one, the talent of that room, because we've been saying it since last year, Darwin Barlow's a really good player, and Darwin Barlow flashes, and Darwin Barlow probably needs more carries. And the other part, I think it just goes to coaching. It goes to, you know, getting a guy ready throughout the week to step into a game and not flinch, to not blink. You know, think back to Michael Jackson stepping up in that moment in Utah, the biggest play of his career. He scores, obviously didn't win that game, but to have that initial go-ahead touchdown in that moment was huge, and he didn't have to think about it. I asked him about it. He said, I didn't really have a chance to think about how big the moment was, and that's coaching. You get them ready, and so they don't have to think. It's just reaction to what they've been working on, what they've been coached, what they've been taught all season, all week, whatever, in practice. So to have Darwin, you know, answer like that when his name was called was awesome to see. Austin Jones played a great game. We'll probably talk about him in a little bit, but I just wanted to give Darwin Barlow his roses, his flowers for that. And I know I went way over 45 seconds. So
yeah, and he's got that radiant smile too. He's got
that
just,
draw, that
just
little
grin.
Yeah,
that's great to see. He's one of our favorite players that we've covered because he gives great quotes. He runs hard. He's just got the little baby face and that smirk. He's a very likable player to root for. And yeah, those were two beast runs back to back. I mean, the first one you mentioned, he took the kidney shot. He took the kidney shot off of stiff arming Tyler Vaughn's little brother right in the face, and you know, just continuing to run as he was doing it. And he turns a little bit, takes the kidney shot from Stephon Blaylock. So back to back Bosco hits. He just keeps ticking from those. He was like a modern day player out there.
And to not like lose the ball too. Like he's turned around. And he doesn't know what's really coming. And then to take the hit and to hold on.
Yeah, that's a tough hit to take.
That's a tough hit to take in like a big moment. And to hold on to that, you know, what a back-to-back plays by number 22. Hit with the 22. Get out the way.
I want to dispute what you said, Chris, about Caleb Williams maybe not having a Heisman moment yet. Because he had 502 yards against UCLA, 502 total yards, and that might just seem like a big number, but that is the single highest number for any player in this rivalry history. This is the 92nd time that USC and UCLA have played each other, and that's the number one most total yardage in a game by any player in the rivalry history. And sometimes, like Shotgun was mentioning, it takes an analyst to talk about it or Twitter to be set ablaze by a crazy throw or a big run, like even Darwin Barlow's run, something like that. But if you set a record that a lot of people start to talk about, where I saw PFF College tweeting about it, ESPN College Football tweeting about Caleb Williams setting the record in the rivalry history, that's sometimes enough. And it may not be, you know, one play, but that game beating UCLA as well on the road could be his Heisman moment, I think, for sure.
And one of the things that he did not do was set the passing yardage record, because let's give a little bit of credit to Keaton Slovis and the four wide receivers that went for 100 yards all in the same game.
I was there.
In 2019. And I also want to give a little credit to the 2020 game. I know a lot of people are talking about how is this the best game in the rivalry since whatever year. That 2020 game was electric. There was just no electricity because there was no fans. But the way it ended, the way USC, you know, the kickoff return by Gary Bryant Jr., getting down there, the Amon-Ra St. Brown touchdown, UCLA having a Hail Mary chance and coming really close. And who was the one to knock the ball away on the Hail Mary?
Malcolm Epps.
No. Close. Drake London. It was an offensive player, but always my boy Drake, you know.
Also, if we're talking about 2020, the Arizona State game was probably one of the craziest games ever covered, and
talking about the rivalry.
I know, but that's just true. Saying, if we're throwing out 2020, one of the craziest games I've ever covered in my life, and not a sound in that stadium. I just wanted to throw that out there. And really very quickly, Austin Jones, great performance by him, stepping up in the moment, had 2-6 written on his wrist all game. Travis Dye told him before the game to, remind them who you are?
Yep.
Because they had forgotten who he was, or they were forgetting who he was. And I think he did that on Saturday night, just running with so much confidence and pretty much made every play that he needed to make in that game. So just wanted to shout out to number 6 for his performance and stepping up when, 2-6 is down.
I think it was definitely the best SC football game since that 2016 Rose Bowl. And I think you could argue that in some ways it's the most important game since then. And you could argue even past that point, the most important USC football game. We can kind of talk about some of the implications of the win past USC clinching a spot in Vegas for the Pac-12 title game. But just what this win meant for Lincoln Riley, for the culture, for all the players that were brought in. You mentioned for Bobby Haskins, you could talk about recruiting. I feel like there's so many different webs you can span about the implications of this win for USC. And coming into the game was very important. The fact that they won it in the way that they did, coming back for the first time since Oregon State, it's a huge win for USC in so many different ways.
I mean, I guess it's the biggest win since the Rose Bowl, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing been quite that had the implications that this game had. And just as far as, hey, they are in the Pac-12 championship now, and they still are live for the college football playoff. They are in the top 5 now. I don't know the last time, Chris, you wrote the story about it, about them being ranked top 5. Maybe you know the date of the last one. But first time during the college football playoff rankings that they've been in the top 5. So, that tells you they have a shot. And if they – the big concern – we're not going to talk – we've been getting a lot of questions about Notre Dame. We'll go over that during the Thursday Tunnel Vision show more. But watch out for the letdown, though. Emotional game. You got to make sure that you bounce back from it and, get back to that even keel and go to work this week because, it's going to be 3 tough games in a row that USC is going to have to get up 3 times in a row, and that's usually when college football teams struggle, when they have back-to-back or they have 2 or 3, big games in a row. So we'll see what USC does there. But took care of business against UCLA, made the plays when they needed to give themselves a shot to continue going forward with all those possibilities. Won the Pac-12 championship and the college football playoff as well.
Carlos is reminding us that we got to talk about someone else. Jordan Addison. He came back in a big way. He told everyone earlier this week after practice that he's going to show everyone that he's back, and he did. He had 11 catches for over 170 yards and a touchdown. Seemed like every time that USC needed to move the ball, needed to get it to someone on third down, it was Jordan Addison. I don't know if UCLA kind of forgot he was out on the field at certain points, but it seemed like he was open just about every time he needed to be. I was shocked at how easy it was between Caleb Williams and Jordan Addison all game, and I think we can all safely say it, he definitely is back.
Well, they certainly forgot about him on that touchdown.
That you can't say that they forgot about him. That's great play design.
Yeah, they got just schemed.
There are a couple other catches, though, where it feels like there was one. It was a zone coverage. Caleb Williams is USC's going towards the west end zone. They're backed up, and they're on the left hash, and he throws all the way across the right hash. And maybe it's just they don't think that Caleb Williams can make that throw. Like, oh, I'll have time to get over there. But he's just hovering over there, and it was like 2nd and 7 or something. So it was a little bit, if they don't complete it, could be in trouble, backed up, and have to punt the ball. And it's like there's no one within 10, 12 yards of Jordan Addison. It's like, why is no one guarding that guy? If you're going to leave someone wide open, like Austin Jones got wide open a little bit later out of the backfield, that makes a little bit more sense. USC leaving Michael Ezekiel wide open on the touchdown. But Jordan Addison, the Biletnikoff winner, like I think someone should have that responsibility every single play. That one was a little bit strange.
We Maryland boys move low key. Sometimes you get lost.
And he was trying to get lost on the setup for that touchdown. That was the purpose of USC. They said they went tempo to get up to the line really quick and then put Jordan Addison in the backfield so that they could get what ended up happening is so they could get him matched up with a linebacker, got him against John Vaughns, and he just ran right by him. And that's just speed against a linebacker. That's a matchup you're trying to create. And that's, again, the creativity of Lincoln Riley with his play calling and, the things that I try to ask questions about that he doesn't want to talk about. Why he's hiding Taj Washington in an H-back spot, kind of duck down where the tight end normally would be, why you would put a tight end in the backfield and then move a running back or move a wide receiver back there. It's all about creating those matchups and seeing how defenses react to when they see 2 people in the backfield because they don't see, a running back and a running back or running back and a wide receiver, usually they see two people. They look at it in that direction. Okay, well, one of the linebackers gets one of the guys in the backfield. The other linebacker gets another guy. And if you go, okay, that's the way they're going to play it, all right, let's have Jordan Addison be one of the guys that that linebacker tries to guard and see how that works for him.
And he said, I believe he joked that they told him to hide his number, to don't let him see who's back there, number three. Otherwise, a bunch of alarm bells would have been going off. And right before we went on to the show, we actually watched that call in Spanish on accident, and I don't think I can ever go back. I think I'm just all – I'm sorry, Gus Justin, but it's all Spanish calls on USC football.
Was it muy complicada? Yeah. Very complicated. Yeah, the previous play was an Austin Jones run, I believe, and they didn't substitute. And I see Austin Jones flank out left, so I think I tell Chris, oh, they're going empty. And then I see a helmet next to Caleb Williams, and I had my binoculars. I was like, who's there? I can't see the number. Who's not out wide? And like, wait, where'd Jordan Addison go? And they snap the ball. He takes a couple steps. I see the number three. I see he's got a linebacker on him. And I look to Chris. I'm like, Addison, touchdown. And Caleb Williams looks that way. And then it looks like he doesn't want to throw it because Addison looked covered for a little bit. Caleb, it looked like he hesitated a second and then threw it, and Addison was just wide open right in front of Chris and I in the end zone. Yeah, I thought it was just one of the better play calls that Lincoln Riley's had this year to be able to utilize a weapon like that. And even with guys like Mario Williams not playing, you didn't have another Trojan receiver go over three catches. Jordan Addison was able to make it work whenever they needed him to.
Mario Williams did play in the game.
I meant not playing his best.
Oh, gotcha. Of those things that Jack just said, one, the first thing that stands out to me is, who brings binoculars to the sideline?
Someone who...
Jack Smith, I guess.
I guess. I thought he had good eyes. I thought he was a young kid,
but if they're on the other side of the field...
Yeah, of course. You can't roam the sideline or anything like that. But anyways...
Well, I couldn't. Like I told you before, I couldn't get service anywhere other than the one spot I was standing
but
in.
But you didn't know you would only be locked into one spot, so you had the binoculars.
That's just
before.
Being prepared. That's being prepared.
Good for him. But you talk about Jack... Jack talked about trying to find, like, he sees a helmet and trying to see what's back there. And that's what the defense was trying to do at the same time. And that's why they tell him, if anyone's not didn't understand why they would tell Jordan Addison to try to hide his number, is you don't know players by their name when you're watching film. You're like, oh, three is good. Four is electric. This guy, that's how you don't have time to learn everybody's names throughout a season, especially if it's someone's name is difficult. You don't want to be trying to remember that as you're talking in film session.
That's why you never ask a players, what do you think about Johnson Smith? He's like, is that 14? And he's like, because they only know by numbers. They don't care about names.
You want to preface it. What do you think about number three, Jordan Addison? But so he's ducking down so they can't really read his number so that they would be cued that, hey, alert, alert, three's in the backfield or something like that. And then Caleb Williams, why it looked like he hesitated, in my opinion, was that it looked like the safety might stay over the top of that. And so he was waiting to see if that cleared. And once he, once the safety kind of moved towards the middle of the field, he's like, oh, money, buckets, put it out there, let Jordan go make a play. And then I thought it was interesting. This is for Jordan Addison, Caleb Williams, several of the other transfers. They learned this motion really quickly. They didn't talk about rivalry much during the week. But a lot of the fours down throughout the bench after the Corey Foreman touchdown, Caleb Williams, I mean, I thought his hands were like basically stuck like this after the game. I was concerned, that maybe he developed some carpal tunnel issues or whatever. But no, it was just the UCLA fours down because every photo that he wanted to take until Lincoln Riley came and stood beside him, then he'd put up the regular, two fingers. But the rest of the photos, it was fours down everywhere. So, those – you wonder – how do transfers kind of get ingratiated into that experience? And from all the trash talk and everything else, they were fully invested.
Somebody clip that and send me a GIF of Shotgun doing force down. Thank you.
Well, they were doing it all game, too. Jordan Addison went right in front of the UCLA student section after that touchdown. And they were all, like, Mario Williams did it on the Austin Jones score. And Brett Nealon, you can look at Chris's field-level video, grabs Mario Williams by the back. He's like, no, we're going back to our sideline. Stop celebrating Austin Jones's touchdown in the face of the UCLA student section.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I saw a referee look like he was a gunslinger reaching for that flag when he was watching Mario Williams. So it was quick draw.
Somebody threw trash on the field at Austin Jones.
Yeah, it was right in front of us. There was chippiness all game. Dorian Thompson-Robinson looked like he got a warning from a ref after chirping at the USC sideline. It was everything that you would expect from the USC-UCLA rivalry. And I thought that the atmosphere was even better than I imagined it. I put out a poll earlier in the week asking followers what percentage they thought USC fans there were going to be in the stadium. I think they were a little ambitious saying over 50%, but I would say it's solidly somewhere between 35-40% Trojan fans in the stadium, and both sides, whenever their team would make a play, were so loud, so mean, using words that we can't repeat on this show that are going to be in Chris's ghost notes, but they were fantastic, and I think both fan bases stepped up, and the atmosphere was just electric, loud, and crazy.
Yeah, and Nick asked the question, could you guys give your perspective on the atmosphere in the stadium last night? It seemed absolutely electric. We've heard from Jack, his first time in the Rose Bowl, getting to experience that. Chris, what did you think of the rivalry atmosphere, and you know, is there a game that you would compare it to that we've covered recently?
A game that I would compare it to that I've covered recently? Well, here's the thing. This is my first time being like on the field to shoot a game in the Rose Bowl. Usually I'm up in the press box. The closest I've come to is the 2016 Rose Bowl, where I was at down on the final 5 minutes of the game. Got a great shot of the Deontay Burnett touchdown, and had food poisoning that game from the hot dogs up at the top, so I did not feel great, but still got the shot. That is probably the most electric environment I've ever been in terms of like on the field, that rivalry, or not the rivalry, but that you know, that intensity, and it was pretty lit down there on the field. I will admit it was pretty lit, you know, with the lights and the shadows, and then all the like mainly the Bruins, when the Bruins would do something good, you know, all the blue shimmering, and then when USC would do something good, all the red on the far end zone shimmering. So with the lights, it was really cool, really loud, a lot of fan engagement from both sides, flipping each other off, a lot of interesting chants from the crowd. I like that there was so much space on the sideline when you're going from around the sideline. But it was just a fun game to cover. The most exciting part for me was, you know, covering games like this, getting to see the interactions and the celebrations after on the field. You get a lot of good stuff. I did want to ask you guys what your favorite, like, moment post-game on the field was.
I think my favorite photo from it is the Caleb Williams and Lincoln Riley standing in front of the scoreboard. I wish I was more of a professional photographer, and while I was throwing elbows, could have adjusted my camera quick enough to get it everything in focus to get the backdrop as well. But you know, that showed me what this rivalry, or what being at USC, means to them. You know, they've taken in the rivalry, they've taken in that it means something to them, and seeing also Caleb Williams, and I give Allison Williams, the sideline reporter who was doing the post-game interview, give her a lot of credit for chasing down Caleb Williams, because he was just celebrating. The game ended. He was down the sideline. He was up on the ladder. He was coming down from the ladder. He was, you know, screaming the entire time, and she's trying to wrangle him the entire time for this post-game interview, and eventually got him, at least showed clips on SportsCenter, so I assume she got him. But, you know, I thought that was interesting because during the game, you would have never known that he was that invested in the game. But that's Caleb Williams' personality, because during the game, like Lincoln Riley, they're down 14-0, or, you know, early in the game, they're struggling on offense, and Lincoln Riley's kind of pacing with his head down, and Caleb Williams is right beside him just bobbing his head along to whatever music is being played during the TV timeout, and singing along, just unfazed by everything, just cool as can be. And then after the game, you see the emotion pour out, and it's almost like there's an on-off switch there of like when the final buzzer is like, all right, he just releases, and you know, the guards that are on him, and lets the emotion free, and that's when you see him fired up, because pretty much every game when they win, he's very demonstrative afterwards. Let's go, or whatever he's yelling at.
Or he has
that
emotion like at Utah.
Yeah, same thing. And, you know, I know USC fans are making fun of Dorian Thompson-Robinson for walking off the field crying, but that shows you the emotion the investment that he had in this rivalry. He was a great competitor in this rivalry for the last 5 years. So it's going to be interesting to see what UCLA does at quarterback going forward. But he definitely left his mark in this rivalry over the last 5 years for better and worse from his performances. But he was carrying that team on his sleeve or carrying that team on his shoulders and wearing his emotions on his sleeve throughout the night.
Now streaming on Paramount Plus. Gather your besties.
We are very exclusive.
And get ready.
Mom, go make snacks.
For sure, Regina. Yeah.
For the movie that hits like a bus. In a good way.
No one died.
Mean Girls. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
From the world of Sonic the Hedgehog, a new hero arrives.
I am
ready. Is there anyone stronger?
No.
Tougher?
No.
Funnier?
I do not make jokes. I make warriors.
Knuckles. April 26th on Paramount Plus.
Yes!
1972, 2022. It's a long time. Jack, what about you?
Started?
I would say I had a couple. Allison Williams did wrangle in Caleb Williams, and at the end, he just kind of screamed out, "I want to go ring that bell." And then he went and rang the bell. But my favorite was.
Sounds like a 4-year-old.
Seeing the Trojans run to get the victory bell, they had it at midfield, and they rang it from midfield all the way as they wheeled it to the big swarm of USC fans and students and parents and the band and the players and everyone. They were ringing it all the way there and then ringing it while the band was playing Tusk. There was Mario Williams, who I like right after the game, he ran off the sideline and was doing his own dance with no one else. And like, it's kind of like he was trying to sing a rap verse to the beat of Tusk to himself while dancing, which I'll put the video on my Twitter maybe tomorrow. But there was just a lot of fun stuff. I would just say like being in that swarm at the USC end of the bowl where the band was playing and all the fans had gathered. It's something you don't really get at the Coliseum as much because the band has to come down from the stands. But this, just in that one corner where everyone was located and all the players kind of swarmed to at the end, it was loud, it was crazy, and I've really never seen anything like it.
It was probably the best scene I've been a part of. The only thing that probably compares would be, granted, I was not at the Rose Bowl for that. I was in San Antonio for the All-American game. Still upset about that. But it was the Rose Bowl that I covered, which was Georgia-Oklahoma with Lincoln Riley, just because that was Georgia going to the national championship game and, you know, the scene after that with the confetti and everything else. That's probably the closest thing to that as far as just the scene afterwards, because there was so much emotion on that, and that's why I'm concerned about next week for USC, is there was so much pent-up emotion from players that they kind of released after that game, and they were so excited and they were so jubilant afterwards that how do you, you know, get back to even keel and then rebound from it. But it was fun to be down there and see those players, especially those guys that, like I said, that we know from 6-7 years of covering, to be able to see the joy for them to be able to go out against UCLA with a win like that, especially after how last year went. And then asking those guys, asking Brett Nealon, asking Kyle Ford, you know, I asked Kyle Ford, could you have imagined, you know, last season going to the Pac-12 championship? And he said, I would have called you a dead liar if you had said that last year. And, you know, Brett Nealon, the same thing, you know, that he couldn't have imagined that they would be in the place that they're at.
Very quickly before we get into questions, I assume.
We're going to have to rapid fire questions. We're almost at the 8 o'clock mark already.
We can go a little bit over.
All right.
It's a big week.
I got no rush. I got no rush.
I might just sleep here, so, you know, whatever.
I lost my train of thought. It felt like, in that end zone, it felt like the world's greatest USC party for like 5 minutes. It felt like an outdoor party.
It was more than 5 minutes. I mean, that was...
Time slows down there.
So from the end of the game, I think it was like 13 to 15 minutes, somewhere in there, or at least from Corey Foreman being celebrated on the sideline. And before you get to that, real quick, Corey Foreman was being congratulated, celebrating, you know, that the receiving line on the sideline of everyone wanting to high-five him, give him a hug, whatever, basically until the game ended. And there was like a minute and a half to go when he intercepted the pass. And there was like three or four plays. I didn't see any of them because I was trying to get photos of Corey Foreman. But that entire time, everyone wanted to congratulate him. And that's not just, hey, someone won us a rivalry game. That's everyone has seen the work he's put in and, you know, kind of the stuff that he's gone through with people doubting him. And for him to make a play, I think everyone was super excited for it to be him to make that play as well.
Very quickly, my three observations that I just wanted to share from the sideline. One being Mike Bone absolutely assaulting some poor man with so much energy and emotion, like Dan Fouts to Brett Musburger at the end of Waterboy. It's because he didn't hold anything back. And then immediately, seeking eyes with Lincoln Riley and them sharing a giant hug. And two, it's, you know, in that moment, it's like everyone is celebrating together. But what I found interesting was Raylan Goforth by himself in the middle of the field, kind of taking it all in. And I could kind of see it in his face and his body language. Like, he was just so overwhelmed by the moment of what they just did and just kind of taking it in by himself, kind of his arms up, kind of just taking it all in, you know, soaking it all in by himself in that moment. I thought that was an interesting contrast to what was going on down in the field. And then maybe my favorite one, well, you were with me, is just everyone's having a good time by the upright. And then Justin Dietich comes in out of nowhere with two helmets, hoisted up, and it had the same energy of a guy showing up at the party with two six-packs of a party that's running low.
Two cases
of beer. Someone's like, hey, DD, and he just has these two things, just hoisting them through the crowd. And you're like, where did he get two helmets? It doesn't matter. He's already gone. And then we lost him in the middle of the thing. So that was kind of my...
Yeah, Chris described it well, even better in his ghost notes. If you didn't check those out, there's a really cool moment or fun moment with Raylan Goforth as well at the end of that description. I don't want to ruin it. So make sure you're a VIP subscriber at uscfootball.com. The Ghost Notes game day is probably worth the price of admission alone. But then you get all of our other stuff as well, all the recruiting content, all that type stuff. So make sure you're signed up. And if you haven't already, hit the like button down below. Make sure you're sharing, subscribing, all those things. But he described it even better in his ghost notes. He said that it was like at a frat party where you're low on alcohol and suddenly someone walks in with two cases of beer over their head. Because it was just, it was
someone
so
that everyone loves.
Yeah, it's just so random that he had two helmets in one hand. It was what? Not two hands, not anything, not carrying them at his waist, anything like that. Just palmed up here. It was a very interesting scene. And it was, again, another one of those guys that we've known for five, 10, 15 years, however long they've been in school. I think, did any of those guys start at the same time DTR started in 1972?
No. None of them were born
no.
At that time.
And the other moment for me was the embrace of Corey Foreman and Lincoln Riley. Because when Corey Foreman came off the field, Lincoln Riley's calling the plays. They were trying to get a first down. So there was never a real moment there. And eventually things come around and Lincoln Riley makes his way over and he has got the biggest grin. He stares straight through my soul at one point as I'm taking photos. And then he finds Corey Foreman and they share an embrace and a moment. And, you know, Lincoln Riley talked about it a little bit after the game about what he said. It was basically that, you know, these are the plays that we've talked about making and, you know, that we think you – the context is they think he can make those type of plays on a regular basis and he's got to just keep working on it. And for him to make one, they were super excited for it. So that was really fun to see those type of embraces too. Like I said, it was a scene down there for sure.
I think there were more celebration highlights yesterday than there probably were the entirety of last season for USC. I mean, I feel like you could list –
that's a good call.
You could list like 15 different – cool highlights, whether you're talking about even Bobby Haskins' embrace, which we mentioned at the top of the show. Caleb Williams had like 8 on his own, like a kind of a Heisman-worthy moment of celebrations. I just thought there were so many different things out on that field, which is crazy that it happened on the road too, because we've seen some victories at the Coliseum this year where the players want to celebrate and the coach is like, no, go to the locker room right now. And this time they let him stay on the field, even if it was 13 minutes, just at the Rose Bowl, in that corner where all the USC fans had kind of braved through a 14-0 deficit, and then really just a game full of haymakers where it was blow after blow, back and forth, to be able to come out with a win. I think you're right, Chuckan, that maybe SC does have to worry about Notre Dame coming to town and being kind of a hangover game. But also that being said, being down 14 on the road to UCLA and coming back and winning the way they did, I think it could also instill a lot of confidence. I think it could swing both ways where they might think now, look, we just won that game. We can handle business at home with also something we got to mention, a lot still riding on the season because USC's still in playoff scenarios. So we'll segue into questions that way.
One last observation.
All right.
You guys didn't mention I thought it would be one of your favorite scenes. I thought it would be Chris's, to be honest, especially when he said three. And partly the reason why it stopped at about 13 minutes – and they were like, all right, I think it's time to start getting the players off the field, was a USC, I think, fan ran on the field and was filming himself running around until he was obliterated by a security guard. And Chris got some great footage of that. So another reason why you should be subscribed and following us all on social medias and stuff, at least while the social medias we're on still exist.
I heard that guy got a three-pack Power 5 offers after that.
I wouldn't doubt it if he's got any eligibility left. It was booming.
The Barstool UCLA account made a comment about maybe the differences between his tackling ability and the UCLA defense's tackling ability that you can go check out, I guess, on their Twitter page. But that was one heck of a hit. It looked like, you know, a safety roaming around. Someone said it looked like Sean Taylor, and that was a huge hit.
But credit to the kid who ate it. He immediately got back up and then got thrown into the bench. When you're, I'm assuming he was drunk. When you're drunk, you can take hits like that all day, babe.
All right, let's go to questions now.
All right, yeah. Blackie Chan plays on YouTube.
We're going rapid fire, Chris. You can do it. I can do it. Let's do it.
All right. Do you think USC will jump LSU in the CFP ranks to number 5?
I think it might take one more win. I think if they win this week against LSU, against Notre Dame, because LSU has Texas A&M this week. So I don't think they'll get any cachet from that, but this would be a top 15 win for USC. I think they would then jump them.
I'm going to say yes.
I'm going to say yes as well. I think that with LSU not having a ranked win this week, USC having another ranked win, or I guess really their first ranked win, I think they move up. Someone asked, can we talk about the hit the fan took after the game by security? We'll go with this one. Steve on YouTube, whose stock has risen the most over the course of the season? They gave out some examples. Makai, Taj, Travis, Tuli Tuli, Pelotu. Who would you guys go with?
Yeah, I think that was a great question there, Steve. I had this one highlighted as well, but there's so many choices.
Is this NFL stock?
Stock up.
Stock neutral.
Stock up. I'm going to start with Mekhi Blackmon. I think he's gone from a guy that maybe gets an invite to training camp or whatever to he's likely going to be a draft pick. He has shown, and I talked to him before the season, what do you want to show NFL scouts this season? The exact question I asked, he said, I got to show that I can take the ball away. And he's done that. Stanford game, here again, the great catch against Oregon State. So I think he's shown what he can do, and he's been a lockdown guy for USC. He's been that number one guy throughout the season and been terrific for him.
How about Kyle Ford just, you know, being a guy who two devastating knee injuries was at one point coming out of high school looking like the best wide receiver in the country and then just got derailed a little bit and couldn't get on the rotation, couldn't get in the starting lineup and was buried in practice and depth charts. And then to have him come up with some of the biggest plays in that game and that touchdown, you know, speaks a lot to him. And you can see he was rewarded for his playing time or his plays in that game. So here's just hoping to see more of Kyle Ford, I don't want to say forgotten five-star, but a guy who, you know, has all the talent in the world and hasn't really showcased it at all yet.
Yeah, there's two Tusk picks for me, and they're actually very different, where it's Taj Washington, who I'm not sure how much USC fans were expecting from Taj Washington coming into the year. He didn't have the greatest year last year, had some drop issues. He was clearly not used in the right way, but he started out as the number 3 wide receiver, and I think he's a lot like Kyle Ford, where he came out of nowhere, but he's had more production this year. Or you go Tuli Tuli Pelotu, who we always thought was one of the better defenders in the Pac-12, but did you think he might have a shot at the nation lead in sacks? Some people are talking about him like he's a first-round draft pick. I think we all expected a lot from Tuli Tuli Pelotu, but maybe not this much.
Nowhere near this. He's potentially a first-round pick. I don't even think we considered him one of the top defenders in the, you know, a guy that was in the mix for Defensive Player of the Year award or anything like that.
Yeah, I predicted that, so yeah.
You did?
I did. Yeah, no, it's one of my bold predictions.
I did not have him on that list, especially not going into last year. You know, I've covered him since his sophomore year of high school, I want to say. And, you know, I've seen the progression, but he has taken such a big step from last season to this season and just been, you know, a dominant factor for USC.
Also, what was he at high school?
A 3-star? Is that what you wanted to hear?
Well, so was Taj Washington. There are a lot of 3-stars making some noise.
Taj Washington was
roster.
Another guy when he transferred in. I was super excited about what he could do for USC. And
he was a freshman All-American.
Didn't happen last year. And you see what, as Jack said, when they use him the right way. Don't just throw 50-50 balls to a 5'10" guy.
All right, Chris, we'll start you off on this one. There's two questions I'm going to combine. One from Bob asking what recruits were at the game last night, and then also another one, which I'm losing right now, is how does the win impact recruiting going forward?
Here's the thing. UCLA, super weird high school recruiting. Brandon Huffman put a piece out that listed pretty much everyone that was going to be there. The big ones that I saw were DeAndre Carter, the modern day top 100 offensive lineman in the 2024 class. That's a guy USC has been on very hard. I would say USC is his leader, but to pick up that win on a UCLA visit, that's great. And then the other big one is the edge rusher, Collins. Not going to be able to say his last name.
I can't even think of how it's spelled in my head, but I know you're talking about.
Yeah.
Who was committed to Michigan?
Michigan.
And is he still committed there?
I believe he is.
So Michigan commit was at a school that did not have football leading into this year and then went to Santa Margarita and unfortunately had an injury. So he basically didn't get to play again this year either. Achupung or something like that, I believe it is.
That's the closest we're going to get.
Yeah, so same thing with Chris. You know, the recruits are actually kept there. The recruit room where they're hosting them at is actually near the media room and underneath the bowels of Rose Bowl, the Rose Bowl. But I saw a ton of guys that were there, a ton of recruits, and didn't recognize many of them. Now, part of that is because I'm not covering as much recruiting stuff, but also, like, it's not the top-end high school guys in the local area, which is what you would have expected for that game. But that's – Chip Kelly doesn't recruit the top-end high school guys. He recruits his own guys and a lot of transfers now is his formula has been recently.
And Marcellus Williams is there, but as far as I know, also there wasn't a bunch of St. John Bosco guys there. Like, Peyton Woodyard wasn't there. Other, like – from the big modern day or St. John Bosco outside of Carter. So those were, I don't know why I say Carter so weird, but I don't know that those were kind of the headliners that I just rattled off.
And then how do you think this win impacts recruiting for SC going forward?
I mean, we talk about me and Gerard have talked about
12
this.
12 seconds to answer this.
Wins, double digit wins are very sexy when you're out on the recruiting trail. Like, hey, we won 10 games, you know, 8 wins, you doubled it. Okay. 9 wins. That's looking pretty good. 10 wins after 4 wins, that's super sexy. So you can sell that in in-home visits. That's a great stat to point to.
And rivalry game and all that stuff. Local kids are going to love it too. And they're going to get into that much, much more this week on the Two Star Composite podcast. So make sure you're listening to that too.
Yeah, and I think a win against Notre Dame clinches a New Year's Six Bowl, which is also, I think, pretty sexy for recruits. I think even if UCLA or USC would end up losing the Pac-12 title, Cotton Bowl might call.
I don't like it when Jack says sexy, so we're going to index that.
Wow. All right, let's get into a couple more. SC Neal asked, do you think USC makes the college football playoff if they win the last two games? No ifs, ands, or buts. I would say yes. I don't think that they are going to be left out as a one-loss conference champion with three straight top 10 or top 15 wins, and their one loss coming on the road to what is right now a top 15 team by 1 point on the last, pretty much the last play of the game. You're not going to leave them out in for a one-loss Michigan or Ohio State who really has what at that point have less less top 25 wins. Tennessee losing this week makes it pretty much impossible for them to make the playoffs. LSU, I think the only situation in which they don't is LSU winning the SEC. SC might get the short end of the stick there, but I'm going to say yes.
The answer is yes. Things will shake out. I just think it'll play out. I said this, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago. If they win out, I think it'll shake out in USC's favor.
What they said.
All right, shotgun, in case that happens, USC would probably end up being the 4. Georgia might end up being the 1. So SC Neal also asked for shotgun as our resident Georgia expert, how would SC match up against the Bulldogs?
Not well. I upset a lot of fans last weekend when I said that USC's the Pac-12's only hope and they're not, you know, ready for the playoff spotlight, and I don't think they are. You know, there are holes on this team, and, you know, going up against a team like of a national championship caliber like Georgia, I don't think would be, you know, USC would do well in that matchup.
All right.
Yeah, can you just imagine, just very quickly, like an SEC defensive line going up against USC's offensive line?
Yes. The question is on the other side. USC, SEC offensive line going up against the front of USC and then getting to the second level with the linebackers. And then if you're USC and having to guard the tight ends of Brock Bowers and Darnell Washington, that's not a good matchup for USC. Now, should USC not try to go to the college football playoff? Should they, you know, hope that they don't get in and just play in the Rose Bowl? No. Go play. Get the experience. That's how you get better. You see, okay, that's what we need to be like. And then you have that experience going into the next year, so then you don't have any of those jitters, those nerves, anything if you make it back.
And Chris, I know you're going to hate this, but what's sexiest to recruits is if you can say we're one of the few schools ever that has made the college football playoff and Lincoln Riley came in and made it year one. Chris, you got 15 seconds to answer this one. David asked, at the end of the first half, why did USC get two chances to kick the same field goal?
What?
Because Chip Kelly called timeout on the first one. So that's why the first kick was short, but they had called a timeout right before it happened.
They tried to ice him.
Yeah, and he got an extra turn. And you know, interesting would have been if they didn't try to ice him, what happens on that return? Because he caught the ball but beneath the goalpost. They had put someone back underneath the goalpost to catch it if it ended up being short. Does USC make the tackle on that, or does that become 7 points the other way for, you know, a kick six type play for UCLA?
All right, a player we haven't talked about yet that was a big piece of discussion going into the game. Fatima asks on YouTube, Gentry warmed up and dressed, but did he play?
All right, so we got multiple questions, so let me get all those in here. Gentry warmed up and dressed, but did he play? Glenn want to know what's his status. SC Neal said, what happened to Eric Gentry? Lincoln duped us again. Charger said, can we expect Gentry close to 100% for the Notre Dame game? So Gentry came out for the second series of defense and played at least a handful of snaps or a couple snaps. I'm not sure the exact total. But then we didn't see him again. It was like, where did he go? And we see him on the sideline or whatever, and there's no noticeable thing necessarily. But I asked Alex Grinch about it after the game, and he said you could tell that he was limping around. He was in pursuit, and you could tell that he wasn't 100%, and they said, we're just going to shut him down. Is he going to be close to 100% for Notre Dame game? No. Is he going to be available for the Notre Dame game? Ooh, I'm doubting that one as well. I think they tried to give him a chance. And now the good thing is they didn't try to push him. He played 7 snaps. I'm looking it up now. And shut him down. So maybe another week of healing, he can come back. But he didn't look great in warm-ups. He looked a little ginger as he was trying to go through some of the drills and stuff. So I think he set the goal, I think, to come back for this rivalry game and tried to make it go, and it didn't happen. I don't know if he'll be back. I think the Pac-12 championship is probably the best, and that's granted. This is all kind of speculation jumping from outside of seeing how he kind of moved around yesterday.
Yeah, you can just tell in warm-ups his just like mentally, you know, he's an emotional leader. He's a mm-hmm. fired up guy. He was very subdued. You know, guys were excited in the linebacker group during drills. He seemed to be focusing on something else. He seemed to be maybe like worrying about what that ankle was going to do, just getting that confidence in his body again. So he just seemed like his mind was drifting to somewhere, not like intently on the game, because we know he's an emotional guy. He's a fiery guy. You just didn't really see that in warm-up, so just seemed a little muted. So just seemed like he was thinking about something else.
He was plenty excited after the game, though.
That is very
excited after the game. Yes,
The weirdest thing was, even though they shut him down, when UCLA was kicking a field goal and they substituted, and then USC decided to run someone out onto the field to make them wait, Gentry was the person that sprinted out on the field.
They wanted that length.
They wanted the length, but I just thought that was pretty interesting, because that would have been after what Alex Grinch was talking about, shutting him down. He still had his pads and helmet. Maybe they wanted UCLA to think he could come back into the game at some point. But if he was really injured, I was kind of confused as to why he was the one sprinting out onto the field for that play.
I don't know the timing of all this, but my guess is that if it was a field goal, they might have been like, all right, we can stand him up there at the line. He's not going to chase anybody. Because the question is, I think he has, my guess from seeing the wrappings, from seeing the play, he had Brandon Peely fall on him in the Utah game, still played a couple more plays before finally coming out. He has a high ankle sprain. So you can jump on that, and you don't really have any issues. But then when you try to cut, that's when the issues come. So they might say, hey, we can run him out there and have him jump at a kick. And, you know, you just use his length and the fact that he's 6'6 and has that wingspan, but it's, you know, not going to really affect him or re-injure anything there. Whereas if he's trying to run after someone, cut and, you know, take on blockers, all those type things, then they feel like he might have been in a little bit more danger for re-injury then.
All right, a couple other questions. Oscar on YouTube says, what are the keys to beat Notre Dame on defense and offense? We will cover that on the Tunnel Vision show later this week for the preview show. Carlos asks, is Caleb old enough to gamble? For everyone that makes fun of my age, Caleb and I are the same age, surprisingly enough. So he's not old enough to gamble, nor am I. We'll be in Vegas, and we won't be able to hit up the casinos, nor do I think they'll be sending any.
Gambling was 18. No?
I don't think so. Am I wrong?
I had to be 21 to be
maybe. All right. Other question. Benswig, we can talk about this one. Will this UCLA game mirror the title game against Oregon? Assuming Oregon makes it.
Let's not even jump into that yet. Let's wait and see what the rest of the Pac-12 plays out, because there could be all chaos and USC could play Oregon, Washington, or Utah still. So let's wait. Focus on the Notre Dame game if you're going to be looking ahead.
All right, which questions do you want to get into then? Rapid fire.
The last couple, there's been a couple questions about any word on Addison. I don't know if you guys noticed. It seemed like he went to the tent after that last catch where he kind of tried to, he had a screen, he tried to run through a couple defenders. But he came out after the game. He didn't look like he was in any pain or anything. I don't think it's anything serious there. I would expect him to be perfectly fine. So for those that are concerned about his health going forward, I think he'll be all right. Chargers want to know, did Caleb Williams talk to DTR after the game?
Couldn't tell you. Didn't see it.
I mean, he might have texted him or IG messaged him or something, but he was too busy celebrating to talk to anyone on the opposing team. He didn't even go to the other side, I don't think.
They'll see each other at massage therapy this week, I'm sure.
That's true. They do have the same massage therapist. Lamont said, I believe this game keeps Foreman and hopefully Barlow out of the portal. Can you think of any others?
That keeps out of the portal?
Yeah. I think that when you're winning like this, you see less and less guys that are defecting for a portal. You know, we know that, or we anticipate that Gary Bryant will be doing that because he has decided to sit out so he can preserve his red shirt. Other than that, you know, you don't feel like they're, you don't see on the sideline people that look like they're disgruntled or anything like that. Now, maybe there are some guys that are behind the scenes, but when you're winning, it takes care of a lot of things.
Winning cures a lot.
Jordan Addison was well enough to, someone's pointing out in the chat, to lead the band. So he climbed up the ladder. He was leading the band. If he was really injured, you kind of wonder whether they would send him over to do that.
Yeah, and he was excited to do it. He said it was a surreal moment to be up there. He said he had seen his teammates go up there this season and hadn't had that opportunity. And so then he said, check that box off. Include that. You know, that box apparently was right beside the Biletnikoff Award. You know, Biletnikoff Award, lead the USC band. What a grand guy. Doing all those things. We have 3 to 4 games left, Lamont says. I believe we are peaking at the right time, getting Foreman, McCutcheon, Shaq. I don't know who Shaq is off the top of my head. Ford, Barlow, more confidence will pay off in these last few games. Do you agree?
That more confidence pays off in the last few games?
Yeah, but getting those reserves. I think that's just a testament of this team, and I think that's what the players talked about afterwards. I asked that question to Kyle Ford. You know, guys that have been forgotten about or written off. And he said it's a testament to the trust that they have in each other. So they see each other make these plays in practice, and so they trust when someone goes in, they're going to make a play. And you know, I asked Shane Lee about building the championship culture. That's something he said when he got here. Talked about it at Pac-12 media. He wanted to establish that for USC. Wanted to build that. Now they're going to the Pac-12 championship. And he said it's the love they have and the camaraderie, the brotherhood that they have in the locker room. He said without that, he didn't think they'd be where they are right now.
If you have faith that your number one guy or your number three guy can make a play just as good, just make the play like your number one guy, I messed up that analogy. But you know what I'm saying. If you believe your number three guy can make the play like your number one guy, then that's a lot of confidence and that's a lot of faith in what this team is about. So I would say if your team is like that, you got a pretty good chance to win any game you're in.
It's still kind of baffling to me that the way they put this roster together and how bought in everyone is. It's unbelievable, really. And that all that credit goes to the coaching staff and the leaders on the team, I think.
It feels like pretty much everyone that they've added or anyone that they already had that maybe wasn't even seeing time in the past regime, everyone has stepped up and made at least one play this season. And if they're adding Shaq, I mean, that's adds to the red zone offense a whole ton.
Exactly, baby. It's a red zone weapon.
Nick Ellis wanted to know, is there any possibility of getting in-season transfers to help for a potential playoff run? No, that's not allowed. Once you start your season with one team, you're on that team or you can't join another team until the end of the season. Now you can go, you can practice with players. I mean, that could potentially be a thing. If you were a mid-year enrollee, that happens. In basketball, you can... There's some differences, but football, no. Alan wanted to know, for me, Caleb was noticeably frustrated with the slowness of play call relays during the first few series. And did you guys notice that at all? I didn't really notice that. Any idea what happened there? Also occurred against Colorado. I know Caleb is constantly wanting plays to come in quicker. Every quarterback wants the play to come in quicker so they have time to sit and read the defense and everything like that. But that's the product of your head coach being your play caller. There's an extra 2 or 3 seconds of, okay, I've got to decide all the decisions the head coach makes first and then go make the play call decision. And when those play calls involve switching personnel, that's when you see, you know, the players run in, the ref standing over that. And we had another question, if I can find it really quickly. Al said, why is the ref allowed to stand over the center for the defensive substitute while the play clock is running? This happened during the game and led to USC burning a timeout. And that's the rule since because of Chip Kelly, actually, because at Oregon, they would run so much tempo and defenses could never adjust to the offense. So they made it a rule that if an offense substitutes, the defense has to have an opportunity to be able to counter that substitution. And so that's the same thing with the kick. And someone asked about that as well. Why did the referee, disallow the play? Because UCLA substituted and they didn't allow USC the opportunity to substitute in to counter that. So therefore, they shouldn't have allowed the play to happen. They should have been holding the ball over. Now, the issue is the defense is supposed to basically sprint onto the field and sprint off the field, and that doesn't always happen. So sometimes the play clock's running out, and people get very upset about it, and that's where some of those timeouts, but that's the rules. That's the way it works. Don't send in a sub with 15 seconds left and think that you got plenty of time. You got to do it when there's 25 to 30 seconds.
That sparked a talking point that I wanted to bring up. For as many minutes as we've wasted talking about Pac-12 refs on this show this season, the Pac-12 refs have really, I thought, done a great job the past 2 weeks, and I thought they made the rivalry game. They didn't take away from the rivalry game in the Rose Bowl last night. We didn't see any ticky-tack penalties. There were some ones that you could say maybe they missed. Brandon Peely lost a helmet on a play where there could have been a face mask or hands to the face. That Bryson Shaw could have been called for pass interference. But they kept the flags in their pocket. I thought they did the same thing against Colorado. No big time mess-ups. And so I think as much as we talk about the refs when they mess up, I think they do deserve some credit for, I think, calling a clean game and keeping it fun, which I think is what the players want, what the fans want, probably what TV wants as well. It makes it just way easier to watch.
Yeah, they were hands off, I would say. They didn't call ticky-tack stuff. If it was egregious, it was called, and there weren't any that you were like, oh my God, how did they not call that? I didn't feel like, I don't remember a single play where you were like, that should have been a penalty. There's no way it shouldn't have been a penalty. So that's a good job. The interesting thing is the timeout that Lincoln Riley apparently called that he said he didn't call, but then there's video of him like making the motion for it, but he's not saying anything.
But he didn't complete it. He was just like,
but he wasn't saying anything, and
then he walked away.
So I don't know. Like that one was, he was very upset about that. I will say that, and it was interesting that play happened. There was it ended up being a TV timeout a couple plays later, and the referees all conferred in the middle of the field, talked about it, and then the white hat went over and talked to Lincoln Riley again and tried to explain it to him, and Riley was still not having it. He was not happy with the explanation that he got, but that was really weird. But those things happen. But otherwise, I thought they were really good.
I'm team he didn't make the call. He got really close, saw that Caleb got it off, and just walked away. Didn't make the call.
A couple people want to know, LP Cap, some other people, Trojan, on the kickoffs, why are they short kicking? Kicking in the end zone.
No explanation.
He gave an explanation.
I didn't understand the explanation.
I would agree with that. But he said that they were trying to sky kick and didn't kick the ball well. So if you're trying to sky kick, you're trying to hit it a little bit further, hit it up in the sky so that they've got
more time to get under it.
To more time to get down the field to cover. But basically, so if the returner doesn't get it, you want the guy in the line in front of him to catch it. But he catches it around the 15 to 20 yard line, and then you're having a tight end return the ball rather than Kaz Allen. And that they kicked the second one. They kicked it. I don't remember who returned it, but he ran up the sideline and picked up like 15 yards on the return, and they got the ball at the 45 yard line. And then they saw Kaz Allen running away from them on a 55 yard touchdown on the very next play. So that was the short kicks. It didn't make much sense. Everyone on the sideline in the media was baffled by it. Everyone watching was baffled by it. I'm guessing Joel Klatt and Gus Johnson were baffled by it. But Lincoln Riley didn't have a great explanation for it, especially when they were pretty consistently kicking it into the end zone for touchbacks to begin with. Just trust your kicker to kick deep.
You're honestly better off just kicking it out of bounds near the goal line. They get the ball at the 35. It's better than them getting the ball at the 45-yard line. I was surprised there were no...
I'm not expecting them to get it at the 45.
I know that. I'm just surprised there was no onside kicks by either side yesterday.
To note that, USC was very cognizant because UCLA comes out, the kicker sets the ball up while everyone is standing behind. Whereas, USC, they get in a huddle and spread out, and then the kicker goes sets it up, I believe. And a lot of teams, that's how they do it. So they were very cognizant that while the kicker was setting that up, everyone was in tight. And then when UCLA's spread out on their kickoff coverage to go to the line and get prepared, then the rest of USC's return team would spread out with them. They were making sure they're all bunched up close to the middle of the field in case they try to sneak attack onside kick. So I think both teams, because UCLA had one happen to them earlier this season, same thing with USC, that they were both very cognizant that this is the type of game where an onside kick could swing things, like in that UCLA-Oregon game. So I think they were both very intent on it, so I think that's why you didn't see it. But it felt like, you know, especially in the second half, it's like, when does UCLA try to steal one, steal a possession because of how their defense was playing? And it didn't happen.
Ethan
want to know, what message does having – he said 11 players with over 100 yards receiving – send to recruits. I don't know if that's – I guess that's on the season.
That is accurate, yeah. I think it's from all the way up from whoever's at number one to Kyron Ware Hudson, who's got just over 100, but they've got 11 guys with 100 yards on the season.
So I read that as 100 yards in a single game, a 100-yard receiving game, which they have like 5 or 6 or 7 of those. So there's several of those guys as well. What message does that send to recruits? How much do you think USC's success is going to impact recruiting? We'll just answer the first one. How, you know, so we touched on success. What message does that send to recruits, 11 guys with over 100 yards receiving?
I mean, USC is never going to have an issue recruiting wide receivers with Lincoln Riley. You should never worry about that, given the history of the program and this offense. This is an offense you just put on the tape. Like, who's making the plays? Wide receivers. Do you want to make plays, shotgun, when you're out there?
Yeah.
So if you're an 18-year-old kid, you're like, I can play early. I can get in early. You know, CJ Williams is catching passes as a freshman in this offense. Relique Brown, no, he's not a wide receiver, but he's catching passes in this offense. So this is a high-powered offense, scores a lot of points, usually has a really good quarterback under center. Who wouldn't want to play with in an offense like this?
Yes, especially if you're a transfer as well and you got 1 year of eligibility. If I'm one of the top wide receivers, I would be looking at USC this offseason, because the chance to play with one of the best quarterbacks in the country, you know what he can do to get you the ball, and you see that with some of the throws that he makes. You'd be like, that's the guy I would like to play with.
And they rotate.
And that's probably why Jordan Addison was out there. This brings up an interesting question. Visual Diction wanted to go first. Visual Diction said, Chris, nice to meet you, and shotgun on the sideline before the game. The sideline pass, I was in all black with a black beanie. Name is Brendan. Thanks for the awesome coverage. Appreciate it. Appreciate it, Brendan. It was great meeting you down there. But he had a question. He said, Ford had a huge third down conversion when USC was down 14-0, and he had the touchdown catch. Rice with a huge drop on third down in the red zone. This is no longer a debate, right? So here's the thing. I don't know what the shakedown is for this game, but the last two games, Kyle Ford has actually played more snaps than Brendan Rice. He's basically become your sixth man in basketball. He's your Jamal Crawford coming off the bench, and he's the guy you're going to give the offense to. So when USC brings in their second string wide receivers, or second group, and they bring Kyle Ford in there, do you want Kyle Ford out there with Jordan Addison and Mario Williams? And, you know, Kyle Ford's probably not going to get those opportunities. Or when you bring in the second group, do you want Kyle Ford to kind of be the go-to guy of that group with Terrell Bynum and, you know, Michael Jackson and those guys, that he becomes – he's the number one option then. So I think that's what's kind of happening here with that ex-receiver position. And not to say that they're not going to still use Brendan Rice. Brendan Rice had a couple nice catches in this game. You just remember the drop because that's become an issue for him, especially because it was on third down. But, you know, he had 3 hands catches. And what's crazy about him right now is that he's making all the difficult catches – and dropping the ones that are right in his hands, because he starts thinking about making the move afterwards rather than concentrating on it. So he's got to get that cleaned up, but he can still be a big asset for USC going forward. But I think that's what you're seeing. He's the third option when they have 3 wide receivers out there to begin a game. When you get that second unit, Kyle Ford's probably the number one option at the X receiver.
And Lincoln Riley did say earlier this week that Brendan Rice is doing what he needs to do in practice. He's a guy who shows out in practice, and this is a coaching staff that puts a lot into practice. If you're playing well in the week going up to Saturday, you're going to play on Saturday. And that's why we see Rice out there with the number one unit. Shotgun's right. You know that you magnify the drops more than the successes of those early big catches that he had. And there's something he needs to clean up. So,
all right, I got 3 left. Lamont, want to know, question I saw, Damani Jackson in on special teams. Does that mean he burned his redshirt year? He has now played in 4 games. He played a handful of snaps on defense as well in this game. But that's his 4th game. If he plays any more, then he will not be able to redshirt this season. The question then becomes now for USC, and this will probably be a question that will be asked to Lincoln Riley this week, is do you want to use him in these last 3 to 4 games, or is saving an extra year that important for him? You know, how good is he that whether you think that – you know, we need him for an extra year later in his career. He's going to develop that much. Or is he going to be gone by the end of a 4th year regardless?
And Lincoln was asked about this earlier in the season. And he said, when it comes to that kind of discussion about redshirting, it's like more often than not, they're going to play them. they'd like them to get that experience, because you never know what's going to happen down the line, whether it's an injury or something. So more often than not, they're leaning on towards, if he's healthy, he can contribute, they'll play him. So sounds like we'll be leaning towards him playing, but obviously we'll have to see moving forward.
Trek Ranger want to know, do we worry that the USC offense has started slow the last two games?
No.
A little bit concerned. I will say that. You want to get out to a good start.
I mean, they convert that. Relique Brown cuts up. They're probably scoring in that drive. You know, they get the first down. I mean, a weird going on with the snap or the long snap for the field goal. You get points there, I think. I think it might have been actually blocked.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one on field.
It looked like he just kind of just shanked it.
I was looking at it through my lens, and it looked like there was a hand on it, but I don't know. But
if ands and buts. But much more concerned about the Colorado first quarter than this week. You know, they just didn't finish in the red zone, and they show that they can do that the rest of the time. And the final question I have is from Ben Zwig. Not knowing the INT is about to occur, seeing how porous the defense played, would you have gone for it on 4th and 22 in the fourth quarter?
No, but I would have gone for it on 3rd and 9 had Caleb not taken a sack. Or 4th and 9 had Caleb not taken a sack on 3rd down. I would have legitimately thought about that one.
Yeah, I don't think I would have gone for it on 4th and 22.
I don't think I would have gone for it on 4th and 22. And you also wonder how different that drive is if that situation comes up again. But it's 20 yards down the field if Relique Brown catches the kickoff instead of it starting the drive at the 5 because he called for a fair catch and, you know, dropped the ball. It would have started at the 25. So could have been a completely different drive than that.
Extends their butts. Shotgun. Yeah. It extends their butts.
I was going to say. Caleb Williams played pretty much perfect. Of course, I think the interception is just one of those weird ones where quarterbacks are bound to have one where they just don't see a guy. But that at the end of the game on that third down when he could have, or well, I think it was second down, could have tucked it and run and decided to flip it out to Josh Follow, falls incomplete. Not only did that stop the clock, but it kept some yards off the field for USC. I think that was the one mistake after the interception he made, which would have been magnified had USC not won the game, but obviously the defense bailed him out.
Yeah, a lot of people wanted to talk about that play and were very upset about it. I still haven't made through all my tweet notifications from last night, but like as I'm going through during the game, why did he do this? And Caleb has 6-8 times this year had an open path to run and decided to flip it out to someone else. One, you're getting your receivers in, you know, you're not taking a hit. You're getting them involved in the game, whether it be, you know, not necessarily in the fourth quarter in crunch time, but, you know, if early in the game, you're getting them involved, you know, you're spreading the ball around and all those things kind of factor into it that, and he's a quarterback. He wants to throw the ball much more than run. You know, I think if he was a run-first quarterback, you'd have seen him take it off for sure. But also, if he was a run-first quarterback, when USC has gone empty set, you would see some design runs. They haven't done that at all this season. When he keeps it, it's on a read option where it is based on the defense. There's been very few plays. There's maybe been three, maybe even, I don't even know if that many, where it's design, Caleb is running the ball no matter what on this play. There's been very few of those, just complete design QB runs. So they know how valuable he is as a thrower that they don't want to get him out there taking a bunch of hits if not necessary.
They did run one for his rushing touchdown. They had Austin Jones and Brett Nealon leak out as lead blockers for him at the goal line, which I thought was they showed that. I was watching the highlights last night. Klatt was explaining it where Caleb dropped back and then Jones didn't release like he was going to run a route. Like he ran to the goal line to lay a block, and so did Brett Nealon. I thought that was a pretty good play design.
I haven't got a chance to rewatch that one. I haven't got to that part of the game yet, but yeah, there. Like I said, there's only been a handful though. You know, usually if he's running, it's on his own recognizance, off of you know, not off a play design. So they're trying to protect him as much as possible. And he does a great job as well running out of bounds when necessary. Yes, you would definitely have loved to see him take off on that one because you saw the open lane and that it didn't work. But if he completes the pass to Josh Follow and he picks up 10 yards or 12 yards, is there everyone complaining that he didn't run? No, it's just that the play didn't work out that time.
All right, let's wrap this.
Yeah, Chris is tired now. We're hour 37 in. Thank you guys all for sticking along with us.
You know, guys, got to get my time in while I'm here. Yeah,
comments are still rolling in. I'm excited to see how many of y'all tuned into this one. But thank you guys so much for following along, leaving these great comments on YouTube. Apologies for not getting the live calls up, but you guys contributed more than we could even process throughout this whole throughout the whole episode in the comment section. Shotgun, if you want some more time, you want to explain to them what they should all do?
Make sure that you are following us on all the social medias that still exist for now. make sure you are liking, subscribing, sharing, doing all those things, whether you're watching this on Facebook, on YouTube, all those things as well. Subscribe, leave us reviews. All those things all help our algorithm so we can get more people involved in the chat session so you guys can go back and forth so other people can answer your questions and all those type of things. And most importantly, make sure you're signed up for uscfootball.com. I think you can get first month as a buck or something. I don't
know. And there is a Black Friday deal coming up this week, so be on the lookout for that.
Which comes after Thanksgiving, so happy Thanksgiving, early Thanksgiving to all of you guys. I don't know what the schedule is for Tunnel Vision quite yet. I don't think we're going to have it on Thursday night like we normally do on Thanksgiving, but
never know. Ryan might be frying up turkeys while hosting a show. Who knows? But yeah, thanks so much for joining us, guys. We really appreciate it. It was an electric game last night. It was so much fun, and we're glad that we could bring you coverage from after that game. Seeing such a fun one, and hope you guys appreciate the coverage and enjoyed the game last night. Because how much fun was that? Rivalry game, intense, back and forth, and for USC fans, a USC victory.
Yeah, and now they play Notre Dame, so the rivalry's not over yet. USC's got now another game on the schedule as well, going to Las Vegas. Enjoy Thanksgiving. Enjoy the Notre Dame game if we don't talk to you before then, as well as USC heading down to Las Vegas. Lots of things to be happy about if you're a Trojan fan right now, but that's all we've got for you guys. Thank you for tuning in. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday night, and we'll see you later this week.
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. Are you still listening? Good. Take a deep breath. You needed a break. This Earth Week, you can live stream 7 national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. So, yes, you can literally stream a stream. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.